Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week magazine, Rolling Stone, and Classic FM. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, country, rock, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. What did Bruce Springsteen do on this very day back in 1976 at Graceland? Was it A, he raised the American flag at Elvis's home in honor of the USA bicentennial? Or was it B, he joined Elvis in a square dance held in the driveway of Graceland? Was it C, he climbed Graceland's wall in a failed attempt to meet the king? Or was it D, he sang Born in the USA in an impromptu concert held at Graceland? So what did Springsteen do on this day in 1976? And question number two, it was on this very day back in 1899 that jazz legend Duke Ellington was born. What was the Duke's real name? Was it A, Martin Luther Ellington? Was it B, Johnny B. Good Ellington? Was it C, Edward Kennedy Ellington? Or was it D, Abraham Lincoln Ellington? Duke Ellington, what was his real name anyway? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of April 28th. Well, it was on this very day back in 1998 that the Oak Ridge Boys performed in Washington, D.C. at the 50th anniversary ceremony of the American Red Cross's Blood Services. A half century of blood collections, 1998 today. And it was 55 years ago today, 1968, that the musical Hair opened on Broadway. Hair today, 1968. Gone tomorrow, 1972. Mozart's Piano Concerto 18 introduces our classical music news. It's an article titled Chevalier, or the so-called Black Mozart, had a fascinating life. Now it's at the heart of a movie. This is written by A.J. Willingham, published in CNN.com on April 22nd, 2023. Bologna. Joseph Bologna, also known as the Chevalier of St. George, is not quite a household name yet. The 18th century Afro-Caribbean historical figure is best known as a composer, sometimes called the Black Mozart, for his bright, virtuosic works and peerless talent on the violin. He was also the son of an enslaved woman, a champion fencer, a notorious ladies' man, a boundary-breaking conductor, and a close confidant of Marie Antoinette. With a life like that, the drama practically writes itself. Now, more than 200 years after his death, Bologna's remarkable story is finally reaching mainstream audiences through Chevalier, a film based on his life. Moreover, his works are being dusted off and championed by some of classical music's most influential figures. For lovers of history and music, or those who just appreciate a good yarn, this small renaissance is a taste of the fascinating fruits that are born when we strive to keep the stories of diverse, under-recognized artists alive. Chevalier had a brilliant life and legacy. Boulognaz is considered the first composer of color to achieve prominence in the European classical scene. He was born in the Caribbean in 1745 to an enslaved black woman and a white French plantation owner. His father took him to France as a young boy, where he learned swordsmanship and the violin, two skills that would define his life. Boulogne was a man of firsts and opposites. He was the first black conductor of Paris's renowned orchestra, Les Concerts Olympique, and among the first black men to lead a regiment in the French army. His charm and skill with the sword made him socially and romantically popular, but he was still beset by racism. Slavery was legal in France until 1794, and Le Code Noir, an edict governing virtually every part of a slave's life, also engendered the discrimination of free people of color. However, Boulogne's birth to a noble father shredded him from some, but not all, of this prejudice. He had powerful friends, securing a place as a musician in the court of Marie Antoinette and earning the admiration of U.S. President John Adams, who once called him the most accomplished man in Europe. And yet, history better remembers his white contemporaries. Chevalier was unfairly called the Black Mozart. Bill Barclay, then director of music at Shakespeare's Globe, said in 2019, "It should really be, in many cases, Mozart who should be called the White Chevalier." Barclay developed a musical production around Boulogne's life that premiered at Tanglewood in Lenox, Massachusetts, in 2019. It is one of several recent attempts to tell Boulogne's story to a wider audience. Chevalier, a new movie released Friday, brings Boulogne to the big screen with all of the sumptuous glamour and breathless drama of a premier period piece. Kelvin Harrison Jr., who plays Boulogne, in the film said it was exciting to see how this quick, witty, funny, and cool figure translated so easily to modern times.
I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol, it doesn't move me at all. So tell me, why should it be true that I get a kick out of you?
Frank Sinatra with the Nelson Riddle Orchestra performing I Get a Kick Out of You recognizes the fact that it was on this very day, back in 1953, that Sinatra and arranger Nelson Riddle teamed up for the very first time. Their decades-long collaboration, 1953 to 1963, resulted in Sinatra's legendary recordings. More than just setting a mood, Nelson Riddle used his orchestra to complement and enhance Sinatra's vocals. He tailored each arrangement to the purpose of the song, maneuvering soloists to best surround Sinatra with the space he needed to shine. The article title is The Man Who Remade Sinatra, The Riddle of Nelson. It's written by Terry Teachout, published in July-August issue 2021 of Commentary Magazine. Nelson Riddle, who was born 100 years ago, is the only one of the song arrangers of the post-war era who is still widely known by name, and that is because of a fluke. In 1983, he recorded the first of three albums on which Linda Ronstadt sang standards, backed by his arrangements, and he received credit on the album covers for his participation. Riddle, who had been shunted into semi-obscurity by the rise of rock, found himself suddenly famous. Ronstadt's album sold 7 million copies and introduced him to a new generation of listeners. What do arrangers do? When working with pop singers, they take songs originally written and published for voice and piano and turn their piano parts into full-blown orchestral scores, adding instrumental introductions, new underscoring, and sometimes interludes of their own devising, all of which may or may not be derived from the original song's melody and harmonies. Few arrangers write their own songs, just as it is extremely unusual for songwriters to make their own arrangements. Both are specialists, and the skill sets involved are very different.
In the sky is my idea of nothing to do. Yet I get a kick, yes, I get a kick, yes, I get a kick.
Riddle was perhaps the greatest of all the arrangers who worked on the Great American Songbook, primarily because of the work he did in the 1950s with Frank Sinatra. The two men were brought together by Capitol Records in 1953 in the hope of updating Sinatra's singing style, which still recalled his youthful crooning of sentimental ballads. Within a matter of years, Sinatra had recorded his two finest albums, Songs for Swinging Lovers, 1956, and Frank Sinatra Sings for Only the Lonely, 1958, on which he emerged decisively as a mature artist, in part because of Riddle's sympathetic backing. Riddle's innovative work defined the predominant post-war style of arranging, which may be the defining sound of the American century. Riddle became obsessed with music as a boy. While early encounters with Ravel and Debussy gave him a lasting passion for the complex harmonies of the French Impressionists, he decided that he wanted instead to write for the big bands of the day. In 1950, Riddle wrote the string chart for Nat King Cole's Mona Lisa, and the record's success not only launched a lasting musical partnership, but also led to Riddle's becoming music director de facto for Capitol. The article skips down and ends with this. Today, Riddle's style, especially as documented in the albums he recorded with Sinatra, is universally acknowledged as the high watermark of post-war vocal arranging. Their making was a nerve-wracking process for Riddle, who confessed to finding Sinatra terrifyingly mercurial. Frank contributed a lot to the orchestral part of his own records just by leveling a hostile stare at the musicians with those magnetic blue eyes. The point of this action was to make me, or any other conductor, feel at that exact moment as if I had two left feet, three ears, and one eye. But the resulting tension, he admitted, was a positive factor that found its way into the record, and it brought out the best in Riddle. More than a half century later, their albums sound as vital as ever, and his ability to overcome his fear of Sinatra and rise to the occasion is a large part of what has kept them so.
I'm confessing that I love you. Tell me that you love me too. I'm confessing that I need you. Honest, I do. Need you every moment.
In recognition of the fact that it was on this very day, back in 1986, that a compact disc of an album was released before the vinyl version, we introduce the Music Research and Technology section for today's program with Tony Bennett performing I'm Confessin'. It was, after all, Tony Bennett's album, The Art of Excellence, back in 1986, that was that CD. Title of this article, History of the CD, 40 Years of the Compact Disc. 40 years ago, the world got its first glimpse of what would become one of the most important music devices in history, the compact disc, CD. 12th of March, 2019, bbc.co.uk. The CD was invented in 1979 at a time before online music existed. It became the most sophisticated way to store and play music. On the 25th anniversary of its first public release in 1982, it was estimated that 200 billion CDs had been sold worldwide. In 1979, the first prototype CD was revealed to technology enthusiasts in Europe and Japan. A year later, electronics companies, Philips and Sony, teamed up to begin working on CDs for the public. They decided on a thin, shiny, and circular storage disc, which could hold about 80 minutes of music and could put in a CD player to play music out loud. CDs were made available to the public in 1982, and they quickly became the most efficient way of storing music. Before CDs, music was stored and played on vinyl and cassette tapes. Vinyl discs were a lot bigger than CDs and could be broken easily. Cassette tapes used magnetic tape, and the music played through from left to right. Once one side was done, you flipped it over for more songs on the other side. Even though cassette tapes were small, CDs soon became more popular because you could skip directly to the song you wanted to listen to. By 2007, over 200 billion CDs had been bought and sold around the world. Here, then, are some fun facts about the CD. The first ever CD was a 1982 album by Swedish pop group ABBA that was called The Visitors. The biggest selling CD of all time was the Eagles' 1976 Their Greatest Hit album, which sold over 38 million copies. If all the CDs in the world were piled up, they'd circle the earth six times. And finally, if a BBC program called Tomorrow's World introduced British audiences to the CD in 1981, but the presenter was skeptical about whether there's a market for this kind of disc. The decline of the CD. Sales of CDs fell by almost 25% last year, and since 2008, CD sales have fallen by 10 million every year. In 2001, iTunes was launched by computer company Apple. For the first time, people could buy songs online individually instead of having to buy whole CDs. Plus, you could store the songs in playlists on your computer. In 2008, music streaming site Spotify was launched. It offered the chance for people to listen to unlimited music in return for a monthly subscription fee. More than 63% of music listeners are now using streaming sites with unlimited choices. A total of 91 billion songs were played on Spotify, Apple Music, and their competitors last year. The equivalent of 1,300 songs per person in the UK.
Every day, the paper boy brings more. And if the dam breaks open many years too soon, and if there is no room upon the hill, and if your head explodes, the dark provokes too, I'll see you on the dark side of the moon.
Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon introduces our rock and pop music news. This is called Brain Damage, and it's from that Dark Side of the Moon album. Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, 10 Things You Didn't Know, is the title of the article. written by Dan Epstein, March the 1st, 2018, Rolling Stone magazine. McCartney scrapped Cameo, a Silver Surfer cover concept, and other factors that played into the band's 1973 psychedelic masterpiece. There are hit albums, and then there's Dark Side of the Moon. Pink Floyd's eternally popular song cycle has sold more than 15 million copies in the U.S. since its release on March the 1st, 1973, and more than 45 million units worldwide. A true colossus of classical rock, the album made its creators bassist, vocalist Roger Waters, guitarist, vocalist David Gilmour, keyboardist, vocalist Rick Wright, and drummer Nick Mason incredibly wealthy, and ultimately spent a mind-boggling 937 weeks, that's over 18 years, on the Billboard 200. Dark Side of the Moon was also a career-defining artistic achievement for the British Quartet, one which marked Pink Floyd's transition from an experimental jam-oriented progressive outfit, primarily beloved by college students and assorted heads, to a top echelon rock act characterized by its rich songwriting, as well as by Waters' mordant worldview. Recorded at London's Abbey Road Studios, the album's cerebral soundscapes, exquisitely captured on tape, and heavy lyrical musings on the human condition, sounded great on FM and even AM. And, perhaps most crucially, the record had genuine meaning. Dark Side of the Moon eventually expanded to include songs about broader topics such as wealth, money, armed conflict, us and them, madness, brain damage, which opened this section, squandered existences, time, and death, the great gig in the sky. As Waters told Rolling Stone in 2011, Dark Side was the first Pink Floyd album that was genuinely thematic and genuinely about something. And as artists like Radiohead and Flaming Lips, both of whom have been profoundly influenced by Dark Side, can attest, the album's music and lyrics still hold up beautifully today. As if Dark Side of the Moon wasn't enough of a pop cultural landmark in itself, the album's success was also partly responsible for the existence of the brilliantly absurd 1975 film comedy Monty Python and the Holy Grail. The members of Pink Floyd often spent their downtime during the Dark Side sessions watching Monty Python's Flying Circus on BBC Two. So when the British comedy troupe ran into difficulty raising money for their first full-length feature film, the Floyd, now flush with cash from the sales of Dark Side, were more than happy to pony up 10% of the film's initial £200,000 budget. So how'd you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, what did Bruce Springsteen do on this very day back in 1976 at Graceland? Was it A, he raised the American flag at Elvis's home in honor of the USA's bicentennial? Was it B, he joined Elvis in the square dance held in the driveway of Graceland? Was it C, he climbed Graceland's wall in a failed attempt to meet the king? Or was it D, he sang Born in the USA in an impromptu concert held at Graceland? Correct answer, answer C, the boss climbed a wall to meet the king, but Elvis wasn't home. By the way, Springsteen acquired the name The Boss because he took out the task of collecting his band's nightly pay and distributing it amongst his bandmates. As noted in a January 26, 2022 article by Joe Taysom in faroutmagazine.co.uk, Springsteen's debut exposure to rock and roll came at the hands of the king when Elvis performed on the Ed Sullivan Show. From that moment on, Elvis was the New Jersey Boys' undying hero. Springsteen absorbed every moment of that performance as a 9-year-old, and from that day on, it was clear to Springsteen what he wanted to do with his life. After being hypnotized by what he saw on television, Springsteen got his first guitar. 3 years after Presley's death, the Boss paid tribute to the late original rock and roller on his song, Johnny Bye Bye. He used Chuck Berry's Bye Bye Johnny for the foundations of the code of the ode, which he added to with layers of heartfelt emotion. On the track, he painfully sings, they found him slumped up against a drain with a whole lot of trouble running through his veins. Bye bye, Johnny, Johnny, bye bye. You didn't have to die, you didn't have to die. And the answer to our second question, it was on this very day back in 1899 that the jazz legend Duke Ellington was born. What was the Duke's real name? Was it A, Martin Luther Ellington, B, Johnny B. Good Ellington, C, Edward Kennedy Ellington, or D, Abraham Lincoln Ellington? Correct answer. Answer C. The Duke's real name was Edward Kennedy Ellington, but the famous nickname came from his fine manners, often giving out the impression of a nobleman. Although he was a talented pianist, his fame comes from his orchestra-sized jazz bands that played lively dance music. Ellington was a strong individual force in the world of jazz, its most prolific creator with over 2,000 compositions of various kinds to his name, and a source of inspiration for many generations. Ellington opens our program every week with Angelica, so let's close today's program with Edward Kennedy Ellington's performance of Prelude to a Kiss. We've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program is also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. So long. Until next time.